Jet Apparetics, and you are listening to Radioactive Radio San Diego. We are in the studio with DJ Lotus and on the phone with Professor Noam Chomsky. And welcome to Radioactive Radio.
Glad to be with you.
So we just have a few questions for you. The first of which is, can you unpack the results of the election and comment specifically on the role of fraudulence and disenfranchisement, and also the so-called red states and the hold they have on the electoral system?
Well, to be quite honest, I think that the question of fraud, though maybe it exists, is pretty marginal. There's something much more important about the elections, namely virtually the entire population was excluded. And we know this very well. And the United States is a very public opinion in the United States is studied very carefully, and we have a huge amount of material about it. The most prestigious institutions that monitor public opinion came out with extensive studies related to the election right before the election. They were released in October. They were scarcely reported, almost not at all, and they're very interesting. They tell you a lot about the election. In fact, what they tell you, in effect, is the elections didn't take place. Public opinion on major issues, the large majority is strongly opposed to both political parties and is very far to the left of both parties. And those views simply don't enter into the electoral arena and aren't discussed and aren't reported. And this is true on issue after issue. The elections are run by the same people who sell you toothpaste and cars. They're run by the PR industry. And you know perfectly well from, you know, turning on the tube that when they're trying to get you to buy a car, they're not trying to tell you the truth about the car. They're trying to project some kind of image which will somehow appeal to you so that you buy this car instead of the virtually identical model produced by the next guy. Now, that's what the commercial market is all about. And candidates are sold in exactly the same way by the very same people. They're trying to project images which will appeal to people and have about as much relation to the reality as the ad for a car climbing a sheer cliff of a mountain has to the car. And that's exactly the way it works. Turns out that Bush voters, people who said they were going to vote for Bush right before the election, disagree with him on major issues and don't know his opinion on major issues. And pretty much the same is true for Kerry voters. So going back to the elections, each candidate got approximately 30% of the voting, the eligible voters, which is normal. Bush got slightly more, Kerry slightly less. It's about as significant as flipping a coin to elect a king. If the coin happens to be biased, that's not nice, but not the real issue. That's why the question of fraud is so marginal, in my opinion. If the votes had switched slightly, you'd have Kerry in the White House, and it would be equally, it would tell you as little about the country for the same reasons. And the basic reason is the one I just mentioned. That's the crucial problem. We do not have a functioning democratic society in which public opinion enters into the public arena, into public discussion, into debate, and you don't create a democratic society by showing up once every 4 years and saying, vote for me. That's something that has to be done steadily, constantly, at every level, local, regional, all sorts of issues. Until you build up significant popular movements, which we already have, they're very scattered, and among them an electoral alternative. But an electoral alternative doesn't mean showing up once every 4 years and saying, vote for me. That's not an electoral alternative. That's just a contribution to depoliticizing the country. And those are steps that can be taken, but it's hard work. They're done in other countries. It's been done to a significant extent here in the past, which is why we have the freedoms that we do have, and there are plenty of them. They've been won and been granted. It's a very hopeful outcome. It means for strategies, there are very conservative strategies that can be undertaken, like trying to create the basis for a functioning democracy in which people play a role in making decisions about within the political arena. That's not a very radical idea, and we have plenty of opportunities to proceed with it.
Thanks. So before we move on, I actually wanted to ask you briefly, could you mention some of those specific studies, people can find them?
Well, the two major ones are by the Chicago Council on Foreign Relations. You can find it on their website. The other is by the major polling institution in the world, the Program on International Policy Attitudes at the University of Maryland. It's PIPA.org, if you look it up on the web. There were others, Gallup polls and others, but they all basically coincided. I should say that the Program on Policy Attitudes gives a somewhat misleading impression, in my opinion, in their analysis, not their figures, of the voter support for Kerry. They point out that the Bush voters were completely misled about Bush's opinions and disagreed with them on just about everything. And they say that it was not true to that extent of Kerry, but that's only if you check back, because they give very sympathetic interpretations of vague statements that Kerry made now and then, which most people probably never heard. So basically the story is that voters for both candidates were significantly misled about what they were voting for, and their major concerns simply did not enter the public arena. So just to run through them, if you have a couple of minutes, the large majority of the population believes that the United States is opposed to the doctrine of what's called preemptive war, which both parties share, the doctrine that we have a right to use force against potential challenges. A large majority of the population is opposed to that and keeps to a pretty narrow interpretation of the UN Charter and international law. That is, you have the right to use force if you're attacked, of course, or if there's an imminent threat of attack. You know, like if it's so close you can't avoid it, then you can use force. Otherwise, the U.S. should let the U.N. take the lead. The U.N., for a long time, voters here have felt the U.N. ought to take the lead in Iraq and reconstruction, security, changing the political system, and so on. The U.S., in fact, the majority of the population even think the U.S. ought to give up the veto at the U.N. So that we will follow international opinion. A large majority thinks we ought to sign the Kyoto Protocol, accept the jurisdiction of the International Criminal Court. Overwhelming majorities think that the government spending ought to be directed to domestic needs, like around 80% think it should be devoted to health care, about 70% education, building up Social Security, and so on. It continues like that. It's completely different than either party or what's discussed in the press. And what's particularly striking about these beliefs is that probably the studies don't go into this, but if they went further and asked the next question, they would find, I'm sure, that most people who give these opinions must think I'm the only person in that country who believes this. They certainly never hear it. You know, they don't read it. There's no discussion of this in the media or the journals. So people are kind of making it up for themselves. Now, you know, if it were in the public arena, and that's really something that's the job for organizers and activists, yeah, that would reinforce these positions. If people feel I'm not alone, they'll be more confident in taking these positions. So that's a hopeful sign. Tells you what we can do.
Great. Okay, thank you. So back to this topic of moving beyond elections, we wanted to ask, as anarchists or anti-authoritarians, a question that I have is how can we win? And that's really two questions. One is that, do you think that the idea of anarchism or anarcho-syndicalism is too utopian? And also, what strategies or tactics do you think that we should be employing to get to what our goals really are?
Well, you know, you can make a useful distinction between proposals and advocacy. Proposals, for example, we can propose that everyone should live in peace and love each other. Okay, that's a proposal. It becomes advocacy when we describe how we're going to get from here to there. You know? And the fact is that when you try to go to what are called utopian goals, they're not utopian, like ending slavery was once utopian. When you try to get somewhere, you're going to have to go in stages. You build up the basis for it within the framework of existing institutions. And you try to change them as you're building it up, and ultimately you get to the point where the institutions change. Syndicalism are utopian. In fact, I think they're just below the surface in the minds of most people, except they just seem out of reach. You know, like, how could working people run their own places of work, for example? I think most would like to do it, but they don't see any way to get there. Well, you don't get there in one step. Any more than you got, say, women's rights in one step, or any other freedom of speech, or anything else that we enjoy. You go in stages. And the initial stage, in my opinion, has to be to create the basis for a functioning democratic society. And that means both, they're kind of like two, you know, principles that we're taught to revere. One is democracy, the other is the market. Okay, just think about democracy and the market. They're both based on the principle, and this is very conservative, nothing radical. They're based on the principle that an informed public makes rational decisions in the political sphere, that's democracy, and in the market, that's buying things. Well, you know, our institutions are simply dedicated to ensuring that that cannot take place. I mean, take, say, the market, if anybody believed in it, which nobody does. I mean, if it was a market society, then you wouldn't have any advertising at all. You know, GM would come out and say, look, here are the models I'm going to sell next year, and here are their characteristics. It'd take 5 minutes, and then people could make a reasoned choice. But that's precisely what they don't want you to do. They spend hundreds of billions of dollars a year to prevent you from doing that. So they show you, instead of telling you what the car is going to be, they have the car with a football player in it, or, you know, an actress or something, and performing some ludicrous feat. That's in order to deceive you into buying it, so you don't make a reasoned, informed choice. And the same is true in the electoral arena. As I just said, you know, the public relations industry, which runs the election, it does the same thing they do in the fake markets that they're trying to undermine. It's based on deceit. Try to deceive people into picking your candidate because of the image that you project for them. And if you can sell the image, it's kind of like selling toothpaste. Well, you know, here's the first step that we ought to take, is to get people to understand this. It's not very difficult, you know, like I'm sure my 10-year-old grandson can understand. Then to do something about it. It's well within our power to do something about it. You know, we don't live in a dictatorship. We're not going to be sent to torture chambers. We're not going to be assassinated. That gives you more freedom than almost anybody in the world has. And people elsewhere do something about it. So, say, take the second biggest country in the hemisphere. I mean, they had an election a couple of years ago in which people could actually elect their own candidate. Pretty impressive figure. Guy never had any higher education. His background is a peasant, a steel worker, a union organizer. They had to overcome far higher barriers than we did here. You know, repressive state, highly concentrated capital and media, you know, fanatic hostility of international capital and so on. But they did it, and they did it because they have mass popular organizations. So the landless workers movement, which has to face difficulties beyond anything we can dream of, they're a mass popular movement, in fact, the most important one in the world. But they're out there every day, you know, not once every 4 years, doing their own, carrying out their own activity, like taking over unused farms and building collectives and so on. All right, that's part of the basis for a democratic society. I mean, the Workers' Party, you know, has all kind of corruption and bad things about it. But nevertheless, it's an actual political party. We don't have any such parties here. You can participate in it at every level and constantly and regularly. You may not like what comes out and so on and so forth, but you can do something to change it. That's there all the time. And the same is true of the unions and the professional associations and others. Well, okay, that's the basis for a democratic society. And to say they can do it in Brazil and we can't do it here is ridiculous. Of course we can do it here. It's a lot easier, but it takes work.
The final question is about independent media and what your critique of current independent media is and how you think it would play a role in kind of the rebuilding of popular movements, both in the U.S. and globally.
Well, you know, independent media are absolutely crucial. I mean, you cannot have, I would say, for example, the landless workers movement, which I mentioned, which is very poor people under, you know, horrible circumstances. They have a daily newspaper which reaches, I don't know, probably hundreds of thousands of people a day. And that's important. The independent media here, there's quite a lot of them, and a lot of them do very good work, but they tend to be, American society is very disorganized, atomized. Like people in one area of town don't know that in cross town there are other people doing the same thing. In fact, one of the reasons I travel around all the time giving talk is because people meet each other. Mm. They literally don't know each other. I'm sure that's true where you are too. There's been a success of getting people to be very atomized. So even though an awful lot of people are engaged and involved and have, you know, interesting opinions, they're very little in contact with one another. And the independent media can do quite a lot about that. But they have to be careful. I mean, they have to think. For example, not get caught up in wild goose chases about things that don't matter. So let's say, take the elections again. I mean, what matters about the election is that they didn't take place. It doesn't matter about the elections that there might have been some fraud somewhere. Maybe there was. But if so, it's right at the margins, like fraud in electing a king. And it's very easy to get caught up in those side issues and to miss the main one, which is, you know, which you'll see as soon as you look carefully. And that's true on issue after issue. And that takes, you know, it takes some work and thinking, and it's hard to do alone. You got to do it with other people. But those are the kinds of traps that it's easy to fall into. However, there's plenty of, a lot that's done. Almost all of the serious organizing in the last couple of years has been internet-based, which is basically independent media. And it's been pretty effective. You know, it could be done a lot better, but afraid I got to take off. I've got somebody else waiting.
Okay. Thanks. So I was just wondering if you have a few minutes for one more question.
Yeah, okay. Let's make it quick, though, because people are waiting.
Okay. So you mentioned Brazil and the landless workers movement. I'm wondering what specific things you think that we can learn from social movements in Latin America, South America.
Same thing we can learn from social movements right here. I mean, every, you know, we have quite an impressive legacy of freedom. And it was not granted. It was won. And it was won by social movements, by unions, by, which had a labor movement, had a bitter struggle here, but the women's movement, by the civil rights movement, and on. The anti-war movements have just changed the country. You know, in fact, it's a very different country from what it was 40 years ago in many respects. Women's rights, interest in the environment, opposition to aggression, just across the board. Well, that wasn't given by anyone. But that was won by regular, dedicated struggle, constantly, day after day. That's what popular movements are. And by now, they're at a scale that they've never been in the past. Like, say, the solidarity movements with the Third World. There was never anything like that in the whole history of Europe. In the 1980s, tens of thousands of people from the United States went to join victims of U.S.-run crimes and try to help them and protect them, Latin America, particularly in Central America. That had never happened in hundreds of years of European imperialism. That was coming pretty much from the mainstream. Actually, a lot of it was coming from churches in the Midwest, places like that. By now, it's all over the world. You know, so there are the occupied territories in Palestine and Southern Africa, everywhere. Okay, those are major achievements, and there are a lot more, and we can learn from them, continue them, and make them stronger and more significant.
Okay. Well, thank you very much for the interview, Professor Schultz.
Hey, good talk to you.
All right, have a great day.
Yeah.
All right, you're listening to Radioactive San Diego. That was Professor Noam Chomsky of MIT, a well-known, world-renowned radical here in the United States. We talked about elections and talked about strategies that can be employed and talked about election fraud and also about independent media and what can be improved there with the independent media movement. Thanks for listening. I'm DJ Lotus, and you can always call us at 619-269-4693 with your questions and feedback and comments, whatnot. And we will make sure to get this interview up on the internet and rebroadcast it a couple times. Thanks again for listening. Sections, days, hours, minutes, and seconds. Direct from the spot, forgotten on your election. Jail laced with fragments, speech clip with accents. Phenomenal advent for future and the past tense. Blew up the room in my absence. Live or closed caption. Watch my song vibrate with passion. The response and action to life or for rations. I come from where anything can happen and usually does. You find tension where it used to be love. I use my word to shine light inside the dark valleys. The dark alley, UK, US, New York, Cali. From this king to all counties, I out loudly. The clamor will to change the thing that surround me. I seek bounty, I stay striding, I keep striving. I seek guidance like the sun at the dawn. I keep rising like that, y'all. Nobody knows what tomorrow holds. Could be pot of gold or a bear pot on top your stove. Still you got to roll. Climb my obstacles and honor those who paved the harder road. Blaze the trail so a brighter day wasn't far to go. So many stories are untold. So many lights that aren't shown. So the world remain ignorant.